The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Give a warm welcome to Sam Lipsyte.
Hi. I'm going to read some portions of the ask, a little bit from the beginning and then jump forward a bit, and I'll try to fill in where I can so you're not as lost as I often am. So I'll just read the very beginning of the book, which I don't have to set up, obviously. Or if I did, it would be a bad beginning. America, said Horace, the office temp, was a run-down and demented pimp. Our public's whoremaster days were through. Whither that frost-nerved, diamond-fanged hustler who'd stormed Normandy, dick-smacked the Soviets, turned out such firm, emerging market flesh? Now our nation slumped in the corner of the pool hall, some gummy coot with a pint of Mad Dog and soggy yellow eyes, just another mark for the juvenile wolves. We're the bitches of the first world, said Horace, his own eyes braziers of delight. We all loved Horace, his clownish pronouncements. He was a white kid from Armonk who had learned to speak and feel from a half dozen VHS tapes in his father's garage. Besides, here at our desks with our turkey wraps, I did not disagree, but I let him have it. It was my duty. We were in what they call a university setting, a bastion of, etc. Little did I know this was my last normal day at said bastion, that my old friend Purdy was about to butt back into my world, mangle it. I just figured this was what my worst teachers used to call a teachable moment. Horace, I said, that's a pretty sexist way to frame a discussion of America's decline, don't you think? Not to mention racist. I didn't mention anybody's race, said Horace. You didn't have to. PC robot, said Horace. Fascist dupe, I said. Did you get avocado on yours, said Horace. Fattening, I said. Don't worry, baby, said Horace. I like big women. What about hairy ones, I said. Parted my shirt to air my nipple fuzz. Horace let me be a cretin with him. You could call him my infantilism provider, though you'd sound like an idiot. Otherwise, I was ostensibly upstanding, a bald husband, a slope-bellied father. Gentlemen, said our supervisor, Vargina, coming out from the command nook, did you get those emails about the Belgian art exchange? Horace swiveled back to his monitor with the mock panic of a sitcom surf. Vargina took scant notice of our talk, tolerated foul banter for the purposes of morale, but the fact remained we had forgotten the afternoon's assignment. The gods of task flow did not easily forgive. Where we worked was in the development office of a mediocre university in New York City. It was an expensive and strangely obscure institution named for its syphilitic Whig founder, but we often called it, with what we considered a certain panache, the mediocre university at New York City. By we, I mean Horace and I. By often, I mean once. Our group raised funds and materials for the university's arts programs. People paid vast sums so their progeny could take hard drugs in suitable company, draw from life on their laptops, do radical things with video cameras and caulk. Still, the sums didn't quite do the trick. Not in the cutthroat world of arts education. Our job was to grovel for more money. We could always use more video cameras, more caulk, or a dance studio, or a gala for more groveling. The Asks liked galas, openings, recitals, shows. They liked dinner with a famous filmmaker for them to fawn over or else dismiss as frivolous. An ask could be a person or what we wanted from that person. If they gave it to us, that was a give. The Asks knew little about the student work they funded. Who could blame them? Some of the art these brats produced wouldn't stand up to the dreck my 3-year-old demanded we tack to the kitchen wall. But I was biased, and not just because I often loved my son. Thing was, I'd been just like these wretches once. Now they stared through me, as though I were merely some drone in their sight line, some pathetic object momentarily obstructing their fabulous horizon. They were right. That's exactly what I was. Okay. I'll skip ahead now. That job that he describes in that opening, he is now by chapter 2 lost. And he's very angry about it. You could say I had experienced some technical difficulties. There had been bad times, years trickled off of jobs that purported to yield what superiors called, with true sadism, opportunities. These yielded nothing unless you considered bong slavery, a few bogus spiritual awakenings, and the unswerving belief I could run a small business from my home, opportune. Still, before my outburst at the Bastion, I had made great strides. No more did I pine aloud for that time in the past when I had a future. Yes, I still painted on occasion, or at least stood at the easel and watched my brush hand twitch. It made for an odd, jerky style I hoped would get noticed someday. I never confessed this last part to Mora, that's his wife. Our intimacy was largely civic. We spoke at length about our shared revulsion for the almost briny-scented, poop-flecked plunger under the bathroom sink, and also of a mutual desire to cut down on paper towels. But we never broached topics like hopes or dreams. Hopes were stupid. Dreams required quarantine. Still, Mora was a devoted mother, which, even if that often amounted to being helplessly present for the ongoing thwarting of a child's heart, meant something. Bernie was a beautiful boy. Good thing, too, as he'd become an expensive hobby. Preschool, pre-clothing for the preschool. Then there were the hidden costs, like food. Funny, isn't it, how much you can detest the very being you'd die for in an instant? I guess that's just families, or human nature, or capitalism or something. But the price of Bernie wasn't Bernie's fault. It wasn't Mora's either. I was the fool who let the starveling have it, who couldn't find another job, though I came close at a few places. The interviewers could maybe tell I had the old brain. Jobs weren't about experience anymore, just wiring. Also, my salary demands must have been high. I lost out to kids who lived on hummus and a misapprehension of history. The bright newbies bosses exploit without compunction because these youngsters are, in fact, undercover aristocrats mingling with the peasantry. Each stint entered on their resumes another line in the long poem of their riskless youth. Not that I resented them. Besides, there really wasn't work for anyone. The whole work thing was over. I'd even called up my last employers, but there were no further plans for powdered wigs and brass-buckled shoes in the Bronx. Oh, he had worked for the South Bronx Restoration Comedy Project. I'd grown morose, detached, faintly palsied. I stopped reading the job listings, just rode the trains each day, simmering until dinner time. Okay. So what happens is he's offered a chance to get his old job back if he can reel in this one potential donor who happens to be a very rich kid that he went to college with and has lost touch with, but has now found out that Milo, the narrator, worked at this university and wants Milo to be his contact in this potential give. So he's just gone out to a disastrous dinner with his old friend where he got very drunk and had to be put in a cab, and it was pretty horrible. Once I could drink all night and, if not, spend the next morning charming a potential donor over low-fat scones, or better, reinventing the color field with my best horsehair brush, still managed to pass the morning vaguely upright in my Aeron. Now, as I slumped across the sofa and watched my child play and my wife dressed for work while I sipped my vitamin drink from a Bernie-deceiving coffee mug, the best I could do was suppress a decent percentage of the moister wretches and wonder how long this hangover would last. Maybe the hangover would never leave, just fade from immediate detection, hide like a deep cover hitman, some human killbot who works the graveyard shift at American Smelter, takes his family to mass every Sunday until the moment the baddies flip his switch. Then my hangover, activated by further alcohol consumption, would return, step out of the shadows in surgical galoshes, press the muzzle of its silencer-engorged Ruger to my skull. The Milo sanction would be complete. I made like I was picking my teeth, dropped another of Mora's pills onto my tongue. Oh, he's stealing her pain medication from her root canal. Bernie flew by on his wooden scooter, one of those beautiful Danish objects the Danes foist on the world out of spite. Watch it, I said. My son flung a wet wedge of fruit at the wall. Mango attack, he said. Bernie, tog soccer, McElgleen, fickle snatch. Nonsense words had become impromptu mantras for the boy, just pleasing bursts of Anglo-Saxon sound, though occasionally he'd hit on one with inadvertent resonance. This last word just uttered, for instance, did describe his mother at certain regrettable points in her history. Fickle snatch, he said again. I went to fetch a wet rag for the wall. Bernie, no throwing, said Mora. Today was an emergency vacation at Bernie's school, another of those hasty cancellations of service we had come to expect from the dingy neighborhood basement where some young people with fancy education degrees and a tin of Tinker Toys had founded Happy Salamander. We did not understand their dense pedagogical manifesto, emailed to us upon acceptance, but had enrolled our son anyway. It's like a student haircut, I had said, and Mora laughed, a new, slightly apocalyptic tinge to her snicker. So far, Bernie seemed no more miserable than he did anywhere else, and the school was close by. But the Salamander people canceled class quite often. They gathered, rumor had it, for retreats on somebody's father's farm to debate amendments to their manifesto, Snowshoe. Now we waited for Christine, the neighborhood babysitter. Any moment she would roar up in her minivan and I would take Bernie downstairs, stuff him inside the vehicle with the other kids Christine watched, or maybe abandoned to watch each other while she scouted Fiesta Mix specials at Costco. We knew the price of Christine's criminally low price, namely that under her supervision, or lack thereof, Bernie was becoming a criminal. Child care was like everything else. You got what you paid for, and your child paid for what you could not pay for. We hoped his school's fuzzy fervor might afford some balance. Still, even now, after so much salamanderine propaganda about kindness and cooperation, no peer encounter began without a gut punch, a toy snatch. I would despair, thrill, each time. A few seasons in Christine's cement yard with Queens County's puniest toughs, and Bernie had the strut of an old-time dockside hustler. It was hard to imagine the boy completing kindergarten. Remarkably easy to picture him in a tangle of fish knives and sailor cock under some rot-soft pier. Now Bernie continued his mango-slickin' Danish circuit. Mora did her primps, her mirror checks, her grooming despotic through the scrim of my hangover. What are you going to do today, she said, whipped her wet hair, buttoned her blouse. I've got errands, I said. Might try to get some stamps. Don't overextend yourself, she said. I'll be careful, I said. Mora pointed to her skirt, her nearly assless habitation of it. Does this make you look fat? An old joke. I mimed my old joke chuckle. Maybe it was some version of Purdy's. What are you going to do today? Whatever Candace tells me to do, that bitch. Candace supervised Mora at the marketing consultancy. They were currently working on a memo about need creation for a women's magazine. I'd never met Candace, but I'd often found myself with a need to create a picture of her. The picture was different each time. Sometimes Candace was a little dumpy or knobby. Sometimes she was muscular and sleek. Sometimes she licked Mora's knees in a supply closet, though I had no idea if their office had a supply closet. Sorry, said Mora, slipped her shoulder bag over her shoulder. Nothing. I love you, that's all. Fickle snatch, you bad ones. Bernie had more mango wedges. Make sure you clean the walls before that stuff dries, said Mora, kissed Bernie, ducked out the door. It was just me and my destroyer now. I looked for signs of human feeling in his dead, wet eyes. We both jumped at the honk. Christine's corrections wagon idled at the curb. I walked Bernie out, strapped him into a car seat just notionally fastened to the seat back. They were only going a few blocks. Why be rude? A little girl in a tank top with a washable tattoo of a monster truck on what would someday be her bosom put Bernie in a headlock. Young love, said Christine. Say goodbye to Daddy, Bernie. My son whimpered, and Christine laughed, fired up a DVD for the backseat screens. It was sacrilege in these precincts to drive even a few minutes without cinematic wonders for the passengers. What played now appeared to be that movie about the crucifixion, the one everybody got so worked up about. So heavy on the blood and bones and approximated Aramaic. Do you think the kids are ready for this? I said. Was he ready? Said Christine. Shot from the curb. Thank you very much.
Our next author is Adam Hazlett. He is the author of the short story collection, You Are Not a Stranger Here, and the novel Union Atlantic, which is new. His short story collection was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award and has been translated into 15 languages. He has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. His essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, Best American Short Stories, The O. Henry Stories, and many others. In 2006, he won the Penn Malamud Award for Accomplishment in Short Fiction. This new novel has gotten some pretty tremendous reviews. I picked out two of my favorite quotes. Union Atlantic is a bleak, brazen beauty of a book from Mel Magazine, and exceedingly well-written, a high-spirited, slyly astute exploration of our great bottoming out from the Boston Globe. Please welcome Adam Hazlett.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be reading with Sam. You can already tell from that reading, but you should get and read that book. I'm in the middle of it at the moment, and it's tremendously good. I'm going to do a little bit of the same jumping around, probably just with one jump in the middle. I'm going to start towards the beginning with the character of Doug Fanning. The book has basically two main lines of plot running through it. One is Doug Fanning, who's a young banker who works at Union Atlantic, the bank of the title, and he has just built a rather enormous house in the town of Findon, Massachusetts, a fictional town west of Boston. So I'm going to read from a part of the first chapter. It's not the very beginning, but it's when he wakes up in this new house of his for the first time. And the only character in here that's referred to in this just brief section is Mikey, who is his lawyer, who is essentially done everything for him, bought the land, built the house, managed it all for him. And then I'll skip forward to a later section and tell you about the other characters. The chilled marble of the bathroom floor felt particularly solid against the balls of his feet. Two huge sinks in the shape of serving bowls, one for the master and one for his wife, were set beneath mirrored cabinets along the far wall. Beyond were two shower stalls with shiny steel heads that jetted water from walls and ceiling. Opposite these stood a patio-sized cross between a jacuzzi pool and a bathtub, the whole thing decked in slate. Walking to the window, Doug looked out across the front of the house. Mikey had done a good job. A stately circular driveway, an enormous freestanding garage mocked up like a barn, and surrounding it all, pleasing expanses of lawn. Through a row of bare maples that had been left up the hill to mark the property line, he could see a dilapidated barn, and beside it an ancient house with weathered shingles, a listing brick chimney, and a slight dip in the long rear slant of its roof. It was one of those old New England salt boxes that historical preservation societies kept tabs on, although not too closely by the looks of it. Whoever owned it didn't seem to be occupying the place. Weeds had risen in the rutted gravel drive. On the one hand, it was the farthest thing from a Mickey D's in a strip mall that you could get, just the sort of nostalgia for which people loved towns like this, casting the dead starlight of American landed gentry, dotted with graveyards full of weathered headstones and the occasional field of decorative sheep. Allowed to decay too far, however, it could cause a decline in the value of Doug's property. If some absentee wasp who'd retreated to his compound in Maine thought he could just let a house like this rot, it would have to be sorted out. He'd put Mikey on it, he thought, as he slipped out of his boxers and stepped into the shower. Downstairs, he passed through the mansion's empty rooms, and finding the touchscreen keypad by the front door inscrutable, pushed an off button and saw the screen announce, "Fanning disarmed." Mikey was good. He was very good. As he came down the front steps, the late winter sun was just beginning to strike the side of his garage. Glancing over the roof of his car, he saw a woman in a blue ski jacket coming out the back door of the house up on the hill, which was apparently inhabited after all. Tall and rather thin, she had longish gray hair and a stiff, upright posture. With her were two large dogs, a Doberman and some sort of Mastiff. It looked as if the animals were too strong for her, that she might be pulled down by them, but a yank of her arm brought them under control, and they led her in orderly fashion along the stone path to the overgrown driveway. At first, Doug thought she hadn't noticed him at such a distance, but then, as he was about to get in his car, she glanced in his direction and Doug waved. She made no response, as if surveying an empty landscape. Rude or half-blind, he couldn't tell. Driving slowly, he turned onto Winthrop Street and, lowering the passenger side window, rolled up beside her. "Good morning. My name's Doug Fanning. The new place here. It's mine." For a moment, it seemed she hadn't heard a word he said and was perhaps deaf to boot. But then, abruptly, as if the car had only now appeared, she came to a halt, bringing the dogs to heel. She leaned down to look into the car. The deeply lined skin of her face had the same weathered gray hue as the side of her house. Without a word, as if he weren't even there, she sniffed at the air of the car's interior. The Lexus he'd leased for the new commute was still pine fresh. "Trees," she said. "Before you came, all of it. Trees." And with that, she stood upright again and kept walking. So the woman who he has just met is Charlotte Graves, who is the neighbor next door. And she has, to say the least, taken a dislike to the fact that this house has been erected there. It's been built on property that her grandfather donated to the town of Findon for preservation, in which the town then sold. So she's rather upset about that. And as the book goes on, one of the third character in it is Nate Fuller, who's a high school senior. And he comes to Charlotte for tutoring. She's a retired history teacher. So he comes to Charlotte for tutoring, and because he's fallen behind in school. And what I'll read to you now is a scene still in the first third of the book where Nate first arrives and first meets Charlotte, who lives next door to Doug. Standing in front of the house now, it looked as if it were... This is Nate standing in front of Charlotte's house. Standing in front of the house now, it looked as if it were sinking slowly into the earth. Hydrangeas had grown up to the lower panes of the downstairs windows, and the peeling gutters overflowed with leaves. At one end, a drain pipe had broken off and leaned now against the side of the house. Up on the roof, the faded aluminum rods of an old television antenna had come loose from the chimney and tilted precariously toward the street. There weren't many places like this left in Findon. Ever since Nate had been a kid, they'd been building new houses everywhere they could, dividing up lots, turning fields and woods into new developments, the traffic worse every year. He wondered if Miss Cartwright had given him the wrong address, if perhaps this place was uninhabited. In fact, he hoped that it would be. But as soon as he tapped on the back door, he heard barking and the scuffle of paws on linoleum. From somewhere in the house, a voice called out words he couldn't discern, and then he heard footsteps approaching. A harsh whisper followed. "Don't be silly," the voice said. "Since when does the devil knock?" I should say that Charlotte Graves has begun to hear her two dogs speaking to her, one in the voice of Cotton Mather and the other in the voice of Malcolm X. Then, more loudly, "Who is it?" "It's Nate Fuller. Are you Charlotte Graves?" The door came open just a crack, and the snouts of two dogs pressed into the gap, followed a moment later by the deeply lined face of a gray-haired woman. "Of course I am," she said. "Who else would I be? Are you some sort of Mormon? They usually come in twos." "No," he said, raising his voice to be heard over the barking. "I'm here for the tutoring. I called last week. We spoke on the phone."
"Did we?"
She considered him for a moment and then reluctantly pushed the dogs' heads back into the house. "Yes, I suppose we did," she said. "I guess you'll have to come in." She pulled the door open and stood aside. As soon as Nate entered, the Doberman leapt up, planting his front paws on Nate's chest and pinning him to the wall. He bared his teeth and began barking. A big, slobbering mastiff stood behind him, growling. "Stop being so paranoid, Wilkie," the woman yelled. "He's got nothing to do with Elijah Muhammad. Now just come away." She scolded, swatting the dog's head with a dish towel. The attacker pressed against Nate for a moment longer, the whites of his eyes bright in the dark, pointed head. Reluctantly, he stepped off, joining the other one, the two of them standing either side of their owner, like henchmen guarding passage to the rest of the house. The kitchen looked like a set from The Grapes of Wrath, the wooden countertops warped and stained, the sink streaked with rust, the claw-footed stove losing its white enamel. The refrigerator appeared to be the only modern appliance, and even it was a pretty busted piece of merchandise. Yet this wasn't poverty. That didn't describe it. It was something else, something Nate couldn't place. "Is this a bad time?" he asked, hopefully. "I could come back another day." "No," she said. "It's as good a time as any. I remember your call now. You're the one trying to make up for lost time." "Yeah, AP history." Something seemed to catch her eye on the red and white speckle of the linoleum floor. Her hands came to rest in the stretched pockets of her cardigan. For a moment, there was complete silence. "I don't do this much anymore," she said in a reflective tone, as if the commotion with the dogs had never happened and she were alone in the room, making an observation aloud to herself. "Tutoring, I mean." Nate didn't know what to say. It seemed a private moment. Already, despite her surliness, he feared she'd be disappointed if he left. "Miss Cartwright, she mentioned you used to teach at the high school." The woman nodded, emerging from her inward turn. As he picked up his backpack and moved toward the center of the room, the Doberman began growling again. "Would you like some water?" she asked, "or perhaps an Orangina?" "Water's fine." She moved to the sink, filled a pewter tankard, and handed it to him. It looked like something a knight might drink from. "Well," she said, "I suppose we ought to get started." He'd imagined a few preliminary questions about what they had covered in class and what he had missed. But there was none of that. She had been reading about the law of property recently, she said, and this had led her to the subject of taxation. Perched on the edge of the couch, she folded her hands on her lap and stared fixedly into the ashes of the fireplace. After a moment of silence, she coughed slightly and said, "It's customary for students to take notes." "Right," he said, reaching into his bag for pen and paper. "Sure." "The 16th Amendment is generally neglected," she began, "but not in this household." With this, she commenced an uninterrupted half hour on the adoption of the federal income tax and the long road to the passage of this general levy on corporations and the wealthy, an idea championed by the populists and the socialists and the Democrats under Bryan, shot down by the Supreme Court, agitated for in one campaign after the next, until finally the Republican progressives took it up as the answer to deficits and the tariff mess. Taft, a president who'd failed even to register on Nate's syllabus, was savaged by Miss Graves as a generally ponderous and ineffectual man. "But it should not be forgot," she said, "that it was he who in 1909 stood before Congress and proposed an amendment to the Constitution allowing the government to collect the money." From an ancient wing-back chair losing feathers through the frayed fabric of its cushion, Nate took in the remarkable state of the room. Every surface from the side tables to the mantelpiece and a good portion of the floor was covered in paper. Journals, newspapers, magazines, manila folders overflowing with yellowed documents, the piles adorned with everything from coffee mugs to used plates to stray articles of clothing, red wool gloves, a knitted scarf. And everywhere he looked, books, hardbacks, paperbacks, reference volumes, ancient leather-bound spines with peeling gold lettering, atlases, books of art and photography, biographies, novels, histories, some splayed open, others shut over smaller volumes, the overstuffed bookcases themselves standing against the walls like sagging monuments to some bygone age of order, entirely insufficient now to contain this sea of printed matter. An excise tax on the privilege of doing business as an artificial entity. That's what Taft called the corporation tax. She quoted from a tome open on the coffee table in front of her. It took another 4 years for enough states to ratify the measure and a bill from Congress to be sent to Wilson. But there it was, the principle established. For the privilege of earning money in this, the people's system, you, the wealthy, will pay. Now, she said, warming to her point, move forward half a century. It's 1964. The Republicans are in disarray, a party in the wilderness, without the White House, Congress, or the court. The Civil Rights Act has just been passed. And along comes a man named Barry Goldwater, and he's got an idea. Make government the enemy. Almost as remarkable as the sheer quantity of stuff was how completely oblivious to it Miss Graves appeared to be. She made no comment about the condition of the place as she'd led Nate in, letting him clear his own space to sit. It seemed that as far as she was concerned, nothing was amiss. And yet, for all the mess she lived in and all her rambling, she didn't strike him as incoherent. In fact, Nate had never heard anyone speak with such conviction, except perhaps his father. Certainly none of his teachers. This was history, after all. And yet she spoke as if she were waging a rhetorical insurgency against the enemies of civilization. And look at us now, she continued. Look at how ingeniously they have coded our politics, using the same line of attack on our own sovereign authority to suit all their other ends. Of course, over time, one begins to imagine connections between the darker forces. But then you say to yourself, no, Charlotte, you're dramatizing. You're giving in to conspiracy. You're satisfying some desire to moralize, because let's be honest, you're nothing but a stack of Eastern prejudices. But then you pick up this. She scanned the books at her feet, spotted the one she wanted, and opened to an earmarked page. And you think, well, maybe so, but just listen to how they put it. Here's Lee Atwater, you've probably never heard of him, explaining how it worked. You start out, he says, in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts you. Backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes. And all these things you're talking about are totally economic things. And a byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. That's what he says, she insisted, clapping the book shut. And so then you think, I'm not mad, not at all. Taxes are about race, like everything else. As if sometime in the 60s, the public square in our mind changed colors from imaginary white to imaginary black. And we've been running from it ever since. As if anything you couldn't fence in or nail to your house were the equivalent of the public pool, menaced by the dark and the poor. But the public pool's not in your backyard, you say. It's nowhere close. True, but it's in my country. Am I not allowed a patriotism of ideals? Is that what we've come to? She paused to breathe. You see then what I mean, she asked. I guess so. Not that you would agree with any of this, would you? She said, leaning down to address the mastiff. He's become such a reactionary lately, haven't you, Sam? All your religious blather. Do you have dogs? No, we used to have a rabbit. Don't be ridiculous. Sorry, I... No, I wasn't talking to you. Sam here is just a bigot, thinks you're a Catholic. Rabbits, you say. My grandfather was fond of shooting them. They'd pop up in the yard, and he'd rest his gun on the sill right there and open fire. Drove my grandmother to distraction. You'd think they'd have come back in strength by now, but I never see them. He, of course, was a mugwump. Have you covered the 1880s? Republican of the very old stripe. Bolted the party in 84. Small-town lawyer, edited the Findon Gazette. Didn't like machine politics. Laissez-faire, of course, but it was another time. He railed against the trusts as much as the city bosses, and there he was prescient. You look at the World Trade Organization today, and it's all rather familiar. The way those conglomerates are making up the rules so they can run roughshod over the locals, nothing the railroads didn't do to the state legislatures. She concluded her disquisition, examining a patch of the mastiff's back for ticks or lice. "I'm afraid the bullies here need their walking," she said. "I'm sorry if I'd run on a bit, but there's a lot to cover." She looked up at him then, meeting his eyes directly for the first time. "You will come back, won't you? Next week?" These last many months, the intuition of others' needs had become Nate's second nature, as if his father's going had cut him a pair of new, lidless eyes that couldn't help but see into a person such as this, marooned and specter-driven. What choice did he have? Thank you.
So there's a couple of volunteers in the aisles with microphones. If anyone has a question, you can just go ahead and raise your hand. There's one up in the middle.
Hey, thank you. I'd just like to know, for a question for both authors, how long did it actually take you to write both of the books?
Sam?
Well, somewhere between 4 and 5 years. My last book came out in 2005, and I began a rudimentary version of this about then.
Yeah, it was a similar length of time for me. It took five years. The first character idea I actually got probably 10 years ago and wrote a section of that, but then put it aside for quite a while, and then started this in 2003. So about 2003 to 2008, and then it took about a year or 18 months for them to bring it into the world. So.
I'm down here, friend. It'll go on. Oh,
okay. My question is for Sam. Sam, working with Gordon Lish, I mean, everyone, he's known as obviously a great writing teacher. What was the most important lesson you learned from him? And subsequently, now that you're a teacher of writing at Columbia, what, if you had to boil down one thing that you want your students to walk away with, what would that be?
That's a good question. I guess they're the similar things. Two things, really. One is to pay attention to your sentences, to how they sound, and you'd be surprised. And the other is, it was something that Gordon said years ago, and it sounds very simple, but it's something I try to keep in mind all the time, too, which is there's no getting to the good part. It all has to be the good part. So when you're writing a lot, you think, oh, I just have to get through this scene, and then just to explain some things, and then the fireworks are going to begin. But you really want it all to be, you want to be able to open to any page and see some fireworks, even if it's muted, quiet fireworks.
I think there's a couple in the back. Or
oh. Yeah, there's one in the middle, and then we can go to the back.
Yeah.
Someone, I'm not sure who, once famously said that a novel is a failed short story, or novelist is a failed short story writer. You've both written short story collections, and I wondered about the comparison of writing your short stories and now writing the novels.
Well, for me, the biggest difference is that when you're writing a short story, you can begin each day by reading the entirety of the story thus far. So, in a sense, the entire thing is downloaded into your head each morning, and so it's much easier to then move forward with the whole in mind, whereas obviously you can't read a novel every morning. So the biggest challenge for me was keeping the totality of the book, as much of it as I could, in my head at the same consistently over time as I wrote forward. I mean, there are a million of other differences, but that was the largest one for me.
Yeah, you could also say that a novelist is a published short story writer. Thankfully, that was not the case for either of us. But I think that there is something so wonderful about writing a short story and being in that world for a little bit of very concentrated, exciting time, and then being able to walk away from it. Whereas a novel, as Adam was saying, you have to kind of stay in this world for a long time and keep it fresh in your mind. And when I started, I wrote stories. I was working 9 to 5, and I could come home and write stories, and I could throw them out when they were terrible, which was usually the case. And I hadn't wasted several years. I'd only wasted some weeks or months, and that was important. And I think I learned how to writing short stories. And now I've written 3 novels, and it's a very different process. But I'm returning to stories now, and it's been very interesting rediscovering that that process.
We have one in the back there.
First, I would like to motivate you in your short story writing. I find it quite elaborating and quite exciting. But one thing I would like to ask is, in your short years of writing the story, how did you get such a graphic picture and illustration into your mind on how you project each scene? Because as I listened to your projection just now, I was transported into Michigan, I was transported into Norbert, PA, and I was transported back into New York City. Since you spent a limited time writing this particular 2 books, how did you manage to get that graphic projection each time? That's what's fascinating me right now. In this libation and this relaxing tone without actually having a picture.
Well, I worked, as I said, for 4 or 5 years on the book, so it didn't feel that short to me. But I understand what you're saying. You mentioned New York City, which is where my book takes place, and I had to. The book actually most of it takes place in Queens, and I had a hard time for a while writing about Queens while I was living in Queens, and it took a kind of displacement being somewhere else for a while to really find how that place lived in me, rather than just looking out the window and seeing it every day.
There's one at the back, I think, on this side.
Since you both began your books so long ago, 5 years ago, right? How do rapidly changing environments like the unfolding economic recession that occurred during the course of your writing the book affect your process, since it sounds like it factored into, to some extent, into the psyche of some of the characters in your novels?
I think Adam predicted the crash.
So. Yeah. The moment of unfolding that was most dramatic for me during the writing of it was actually right when I finished it, because that's when the Lehman Brothers collapsed, and I had just been writing about the Fed and this troubled bank. I didn't mention that when I was up there, but one of the other main characters in the book is the president of the New York Fed. I think any time you're writing about the world as we're living in it now, which, you know, Sam and I are both doing, you have to be a little bit aware of the echoes that are going to be happening for your reader. So I just think it's something you... I was never trying to stay ahead of a headline. I was never trying to write something that... I was worried that banking was going to be dull and people weren't going to know what the Fed was. So it was not... With an idea of currency, but you know, for instance, there were just small choices I made. Like, there's no name of a president in the book. There are just certain things that I choose not to do that are going to kick the reader out of the experience of whatever scene they're in, to then get themselves to check on whether this seems up to date, quote unquote. So, I guess that's what I would say.
I would agree with that. It's really important to leave out some of those markers so that if you're not writing the CNN novel or something, it's seeping in somehow. But with my book, my narrator and many of my narrators tend to think the world has already gone to hell. So I start from that premise. So when things got really bad all around, it just kind of fit smoothly with what I was doing.
There's another one in the back there.
It's a question for Adam. I've read your short stories with a lot of pleasure, and the thing that really surprised me about the novel, I'm about 80% through, and this wouldn't be clear if people only know the book from your reading, is it's made me fall out of my chair laughing twice. Uh-huh. And it's about it's what you set up. It's about plot as much about like witty language or anything. And so that was really a wonderful kind of new thing to see in your work. And I feel like it's like a farce with a mood disorder. It's
a farce with a mood disorder?
Yeah, because there's all those other things that are always in your other work still going on. And right. We heard those in the reading today. But then there's this like amazing like comic panache in the book that just seems to be building. So I guess my question is, hearing you talking about like not being able to read the book every day as you go through, is did you set out to kind of find a comic dimension in the book, or did that kind of come out of the writing? Was that a surprise? Was that a discovery of the daily work? Because it was really it's stunning, and I think the book, you don't know what the book is until you know that that's part of it, I think, somehow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd say each... You know, I started, I'd never written a novel before, so I was really kind of at sea at the beginning, and I always work starting with an individual character before knowing where they're headed or what relation they have to other people in the book or what the plot is. So, but I think if you're going to spend that long with a given character, you've got to have there's got to be some pleasure in the writing, because otherwise I don't think the reader will take any pleasure. It's not most of the time fun to be writing, but ultimately somehow you've got to get to a place where there's some enjoyment in it. And so, you know, some of these characters, definitely Charlotte and Nate with his high school crew and so forth, I eventually sort of found the place where I was having fun writing about these people. So I don't think... I mean, being comic in writing, as I'm sure you know, Sam could talk a lot about too. If it's too deliberate an intent, it's not going to work, because it's not, you know, it's not joke telling, obviously. But I think you have to actually find it entertaining and rich, and so that's what I sort of eventually drove myself to do. Yeah. Oh, we got one here and then a second-time customer.
A question to both authors. The books that you write, are all those books nonfiction or fiction?
Sorry, are they fiction or nonfiction?
Yes.
Mine are all fiction.
Mine are all fiction, too.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yes.
Thanks. And what's your name, both authors?
I'm Sam Lipsyte.
And I'm Adam Hislett.
Another one down here in front. Right here, second room.
Sorry for the second question, but I was just... there's another for Sam as well. Sorry to get so wrapped up in the sort of cult of Gordon Lish, but another question I have is... just because I've been through
an, for you.
Yeah. just because I've been through a master's program in creative writing, and there's certain... I think every... professor sort of gives you one or two lessons that sort of really stay with you. What's the most important, because he's such a sort of powerful presence, I think, in a lot of different writers' lives. Everyone who sort of worked with him has mentioned the sort of effect that he's had on their work. What was the most important lesson that you sort of had to forget in order to move on with your writing, that you sort of couldn't hold yourself to?
Oh, dear.
Well.
Cut that word.
It wasn't, I don't think it was a lesson. It was a feeling. because Gordon could be a very stern teacher. And you would perhaps start reading from a piece you're writing, and he would stop you mid-sentence in the first sentence to explain to you why everything about that was fraudulent. And it worked for me because I didn't really have much of a writer's ego at the time. But for other people, it was devastating. I found it incredibly illuminating and inspiring. But for a while you're in that process, you write with a certain amount of fear, I think. And that's the thing you have to lose if you're going to make your own work, is lose the sense that you're trying to please a person, a single person.
Adam, I'm sure you can speak to that, too. Do you have a forced lesson from a writing professor?
I don't know that I have...
Or something that you had to forget in order to come to your
I suppose in one instance, I remember being told that that something sounded too much like another writer, and therefore I should stop writing like that, which was a little bit of a blunt instrument, only because inevitably one would work through. And I think sometimes imitation is it can be useful, and the idea that you would, especially for identifying the music or rhythm in prose, imitation is actually one of the things that allows you to talk about that, which is otherwise very difficult to talk about in a classroom, the rhythm of prose. So I guess that's one thing.
I would agree with that, too, because why did we get into this? But we wanted to write like these people that we love reading. You know?
Yeah, and what you fall in love with isn't the facts contained in the sentences.
Right. It's you fall in love with the style.
Yeah, right? Yeah, the rhythm.
And then you find your own, but you have to write through it. Yeah.
So
we have time for a couple more if anyone else wants to venture out.
Hi, welcome, and thank you for the reading. Novelists need to listen to voices, and I wonder, this is a question for Adam, if you could talk about writing about a character who's listening to voices and what that's like doing that. You've done it several times, like with Hester in one of your stories.
Yeah.
And now with Charlotte.
Yeah. I guess the first thing I would say to sort of step back is that one of my frustrations often with contemporary fiction can be that the world is one of the things I love about Sam's stuff, this is not true at all, is that the world outside of individual relationships is somehow just gone. It's like politics and the grind of the world we live in is lobotomized. And we're in a world of domestic conflict minus everything else. So in having someone like Charlotte, she is a political junkie. I'm a political junkie. And she's someone who has this fervent belief in liberal humanism. And I guess what I came to was the idea that if you have these ideas circling your head, as many of us do, it's then not that difficult to imagine that those voices would just somehow leap out a little bit into the world. And for her, the natural place for them to leap out are to her companions, the dogs that are already there. From a writing standpoint, the thing that it allowed me is a certain rhetorical register that otherwise is just harder to get into a book. So I get the voice, both actual quotes from Mather and Malcolm X, but then also my own invention of what their language might be in the dramatized context. So again, it's actually tied into the other question. It's a source of pleasure because those are rhetoricians that I love. And, I mean, their writing is satisfying to read and to listen to and to hear. So, yeah, it's actually when I first fell in love with writing was when my older brother actually said, would read to me not whole pages or whole stories, but individual lines or paragraphs that I had no idea what the context was, whether it was Proust or Nietzsche or anything. And he would just say, isn't that a great sentence? And so it was the satisfaction of individual sentences that it was the first thing that I was excited about.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.